chapters 4, 5 and 6 of the Bhagavad Gita in a way dilate upon the discipline that is required in the practice of yoga. Some aspect of it I touched upon yesterday, and the study we made already is the foundational character of spiritual discipline in a sense. Spiritual discipline, which may be considered to be almost the same as what you regard as self-control, is a many-sided spiritual effort. The whole of yoga is self-restraint and a simultaneous self-recovery. It is dying to live, as Swami Shivanji Maharaj used to say many a time. The process of vairagya and abhyasa constitutes a sort of dying for the sake of a living in a higher sense. This dying is not a loss. You will bring back to your memories what I told you yesterday. It is a gaining of the originality of things by awakening from one's involvement in the phenomenality of things. Thus, a rising of the spirit from this world involvement is not a loss of contact or relationship with the world. It is a rising to the consciousness of the true nature of things. It is hard for the common individual, the lay mind, to appreciate the meaning of this self-recovery or self-establishment, inasmuch as the human mind is so much engrossed in relational contact with objects of sense that the objects and the body of one's own personality have become more real than what you consider as the originality of things, which to our present state of understanding appear as mere abstractions. Realities look like concepts, while when we go deep into the matter by a thoroughgoing analysis of the circumstances of life, we will realize our experience of this world is a conceptual involvement, a phenomenal association, a contrivance, a makeshift, a tentative adjustment, which cannot be regarded as a permanent state of affairs. The transitional character of the world, so much spoken of, is the outcome of a necessity felt in every corner of creation to effect moment-to-moment adjustments between subject and object, on account of it being impossible for any condition to be perpetually in that condition only. The urge of the finite in the direction of the infinite is a perennial call from the infinite. It is an incessant movement of the finite towards the infinite, a flow which is continuous like the movement of waters in a river. Our life may be considered to be such a movement, a flow, an analogy with which we are not very unfamiliar. Life is like the flow of a river or the burning of the flame of a lamp, which appears to maintain a substantiality and a solidity for all perceptional purposes, but is in fact a process rather than an existence. Thus, the reality of the world seems to be a process rather than being as such. So, we are many a time told that man is to be, he never is. We are to be yet. This is a slant given to the conditions of life in certain discourses of the Buddha, a point made out in Buddhist philosophy concerning the transient nature of things, which has been given a metaphysical touch by certain modern thinkers like the well-known Alfred North Whitehead, a physicist turned a philosopher, who speaks like Buddha and speaks like Acharya Shankara, speaks like Hegel, speaks like Einstein, and speaks like Plato from many angles of vision. What we learn from all these discussions and analysis is that this world we live in is not a permanent home of any person. We are located in a particular condition of a process which is incessantly active, which never rests, and which moves without sleep because of the fact that the relationship of the finite to the infinite is an indescribable impulse of the whole phenomenal nature in the direction of the heart of all things, the core of all existence, which is a consciousness of an infinite center operating at the back of all phenomenal diversities. So when we enter into the path of yoga, we gradually discover and come to know that in this arduous adventure of ours, we are tending to become more and more non-individual in our perspective, in our needs, and in our operations, so that the practice of yoga ceases to be a purely individual affair. It has relationships with many other things and perhaps all things of which this vast universe may consist. As threads are involved in a widespread fabric, our so-called individuality is involved in this network of creational process. Though due to the hardness of the ego, the intensity of our psychophysical affirmation, we may not be cognizant of our larger involvement in the setup of things and may go complacent that we are merely this hard bodily individuality, when we analyze our involvement psychologically and we become more philosophical in our thinking, we would be compelled to shed this complacency and we will be face to face with a new vista of things, wherein and whereby we discover our involvement in a larger setup of nature of the universe. This is a great solace which will be administered into us by the Bhagavad Gita as we proceed further and further through the chapters until we reach an apotheosis of this analysis. And the truth is unveiled in a sort of apocalypse, the Vishwarupa, to be described in the 11th chapter. I try to continue the thread from where I left yesterday concerning the relationship between the lower self and the higher self, to which reference will be made in the 5th and the 6th chapters particularly. The essence of yoga practice may be said to be summed up in 2 verses towards the end of the 5th chapter, to be detailed further on in the 6th. And these 2 verses are concise and pithy. Sparshan kritva bahir bhakyam chatushchayva antare bhruvoho pranapanav samo kritva bhakyabhyantara jarino yatendriya mano buddharam mano yadir mochavarayana vigadeccha bhayakroho yasada mukta evasa. These 2 verses sow the seed for the elaboration in the 6th chapter on Dhyana Yoga or meditation, the integration of personality. The senses are to be withdrawn from their contact with the objects. The objects are to be shut out from their relationship to the senses. Sparshan kritva bahi bhakya. Here, there is something interesting for us to know. The necessity to sever sensory contact with external objects arises on account of a basic error involved in this contact. All contacts are wombs of pain, says the Gita in another place. Yehi sansparshaja bhogah dukkhayo ne evade adyantavantah. The desire of the mind to come in contact with objects through the senses arises on account of the mistaken notion that pleasure rises from the objects. As milk is oozed out from the udder of the cow, it appears as objects ooze out satisfaction, joy, a nectar seems to be milked out of the objects by the senses through their contact. This is a gross mistake. There is no such thing taking place. The joys of life arise on account of a circumstance quite different from what we imagine in our minds, out of point altogether from the connection of the senses with physical objects. Firstly, a real contact with objects is not possible due to the operation of a differentiating factor which cuts off the subject from the objects, space and time. This screen which is hanging in front of our eyes, space-time as you call it, prevents a real communion of the subject with the object, and all contact is finally a desire for such a communion which is never attained. Thus the desire is never fulfilled finally, because the contact which is the objective behind the manifestation of a desire is never really attained. There is only a tantalizing phenomenon taking place, misleading the mind and completely defeating the senses of their purpose. The objects repel the senses because of the impossibility of coming in contact with the objects. The desire for an object, as I mentioned, is the desire for union with the object, possession of the object, enjoyment of the object. By an entry into it, if it were possible, and the bringing the object so close to oneself that the distinction between oneself and the object is abolished in a space-transcending experience. But this is not possible in this world of space and time. We can never really come in contact with anything in this world. We cannot possess anything in this world because of this difficulty. The externality principle, which is space-time, or you may call it by any other name, is so vehemently active that it will not permit the coming in contact of one thing with another in the manner of a communion or an entry of one thing into another. A can never become B. A is A, B is B. Subject is subject, object is object. Thus everyone gets defeated in this world. And no one goes from here with the satisfaction that the objectives of life craved for have been really fulfilled or attained. This is one of the reasons why the desire for contact with objects of senses is futile finally. Parinama, tapa, samskara are some of the points mentioned in a sutra of Patanjali as factors which should dissuade anyone from enshrining in one's heart an inordinate longing for anything in this world. The consequence of the fulfillment of a desire is an increase of that desire and not a fulfillment of the desire. Na jatu kamah kamana upabhogena shamyati Havisha Krishna Vartmeva Bhuya Evabhi Vartati. Desire flames up like raging fire which is fed with clarified butter when it is attempted to be fulfilled, and desire is never extinguished by its being fed with the fuel of sense objects. The reason is, every enjoyment, every sensory contact effecting this imagined satisfaction acts as a medium to confirm this error that joy arises from the objects. So there is a reinforcement of the error that joy is embedded in the objects, so one goes more and more towards the objects and does not learn a lesson that a mistake has been involved in this craving of the senses for objects. Thus, the consequence of the fulfillment of a desire is an increased impetuosity of the desire, not the fulfillment. A desire is never fulfilled. It only gets increased. Secondly, there is anxiety attending upon the desire to enjoy or possess the objects of sense. There is restlessness of mind before one comes in contact with the object of one's longing. Distress regarding the possibility or otherwise of one's success in attaining one's objective. Will I succeed or will I not succeed? This is the agony and the anguish that attends upon the desire to come in contact with an object. But once the contact is established and there is a conviction that the object is under one's possession, there is another anxiety. Namely, how long will it be with me? I may be dispossessed of it. Because subconsciously we know that no object can be possessed by us for a long time, much less forever. There is a subtle, distressing feeling at the root of our personality. Even during the process of the so-called enjoyment of an object of sense, so there is no unadulterated happiness even when we are apparently enjoying the so-called imagined happiness by contact of sense with object. There is sorrow at the root of all things, even at the base of this apparent momentary satisfaction. Such a joy is compared sometime in our scriptures to the cool shadow that you may enjoy under the hood of a cobra. It is cool, no doubt, and you also know many other things about it. Such is this world. There is anxiety before and anxiety during the so-called possession of the object, and you need not mention your condition after you are dispossessed of the object. You are in hell. Oh, there is bereavement, there is loss, there is destruction. I am done for. So you were not happy earlier, you were not happy in the middle, and you are not happy afterwards. So in past, present and future, desire keeps you in tenterhooks. There is no joy in this world. Yehi samsparashaja bhoga dukha yonaya. Parinama tapa, consequence and anxiety. There is also samskara dukha, mentioned by Patanjali in one of the sutras, the impressions created by the fulfillment of a desire will be enough to cast you, hurl you into rebirth. Because the samskaras, vasanas, or the grooves formed in the mind by the erroneous notion that joy is in the object, these grooves will become conditioning factors of the future destiny of the individual. And they will go on playing the same tune like a gramophone record, so that you will never forget an earlier enjoyment. They will be harassing you even in your dream, and they can persist even after the shedding of this body. Rebirth is caused by unfulfilled desire. The frailty of this body and the fickleness of our social relationships are such that all our desires cannot be fulfilled in the short span of life. Hence, something always remains as the residue unfulfilled, which rockets forth our subtle body
to that particular condition in space-time where these unfulfilled longings can materialize, this process is called rebirth. Thus, the agony continues even in the future life. Samskara dukkha. Fourthly, there is a philosophical or a metaphysical reason behind the impossibility to come in contact with real happiness in this world. That is, the perpetual rotation of the very constituents of Prakriti, Sattva, Rajas and Tamas. What you call happiness is the preponderance of Sattva, the equilibrating power of nature, which we rarely pass through and experience in life on account of our being always mostly under the pressure of a desire which is unfulfilled, which is nothing but rajas acting, distracting our attention. There is a perpetual other consciousness, an awareness that things are outside, which keeps us in a rajasic mood. Rajas is a condition of consciousness where it is forced to be aware of things other than its own self. Duality consciousness, separation consciousness, object consciousness, and all these things attending upon this consciousness come under the activity of rajas, which separates, dissects, cuts off one thing from the another, especially the subject from the object. The movement of Prakriti, the rotation of the wheel of this natural process consisting of Sattva, Rajas and Tamas never allows you to be in a permanent condition. Like the movement of a wheel which is in motion, conditions of Prakriti are perpetually moving for the fulfillment of their own purpose, which is not necessarily your individual purpose. When there is a momentary cessation of rajasic activity, a flash of a second as it were, when we come in contact with an object, there is a preponderating feeling that the need for the movement of our mind towards the object ceases. When you are in possession of an object of desire, the need for the mind to be conscious of the object as an external something ceases. Rajas does not operate for that flash of a moment, and the cessation of rajas is also a cessation of this other consciousness, object consciousness, which is tantamount to self-consciousness. You turn to your own self for the split fraction of a second as it were, and consciousness, which is the essence of your Atman or the self, tastes its own source, licks the bliss of its own essentiality, and finds itself in a state of ecstasy. Because the more you are in union with your own self, the more intense is the satisfaction you feel, the rapture that you are in, the delight that you experience. All ananda, all joy is a union of the subject with its own self. Now I turn your attention to a definition of this self, which is a crucial point in our study of the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which describes the art of meditation. The science of self-integration by means of an inward communion of the lower self with the higher self. This was the subject of our study yesterday. We have first of all to decondition our minds from assuming any notion already about the characteristic of the higher self, the lower self, etc. All our learning about this has to be foregone for the time being, because many of us may not have a correct notion of what this self means. We are mostly under a misapprehension concerning the nature of the self. If you can recollect what I told you yesterday, it is a name that we give to pure subjectivity of awareness. We are never in this condition at any time in this world. We do not enjoy an experience of pure subjectivity at any time, except in a perforce way in the state of deep sleep, when we be said to be purely subjective. But that does us no good, because of an absence of what is happening to us there. Incidentally, the intensity of the joy that you feel in the state of deep sleep is due to your union with your own self unconsciously though. However, the point is that this union with the pure subject has to be effected in a conscious way, and a conscious endeavor on the part of oneself to commune with this true self in the various levels or degrees of its ascent may be said to be the function of yoga practice. All yoga is the art of communing oneself with oneself. Again, we are here in a difficulty in the matter of understanding what this oneself means. Everyone knows what this oneself is. I am here, myself. You are there, yourself. We speak in this strain, but this is a physical, social, and psychical way of defining the self. But the self, to reiterate, is pure subjectivity, and the psychological, physical, or social self is an objectified form of self. In the language of the Vedanta, the self is supposed to be understood by us in three ways, namely, the apparent self, which we seem to recognize in all objects of our longing or desire, a self which seems to be present in everything with which we are vitally connected, especially through our emotions, known as the Gaunatman or the secondary self. The son loves his father, the father loves his son. You cannot say that the son is the father or the father is the son. There is no intelligible explanation as to why the father should cling to his son as if he is his own self. However, the father loves his son as if the son is his own self, and the joy of the son is the joy of the father, the sorrow of the son is the sorrow of the father. Anything that happens to the son happens to the father. The birth and death of the son is the birth and death of the father, as it were, as we see in social parlance. How come? that the father sees himself in the son. The rich man sees himself in his wealth. And anyone fired up with an intense passion of any kind sees himself or herself in that object which is the target of this feeling. This particular object which forces the subject to direct its attention towards itself. This power in the object which necessitates the subject to pour itself upon itself, on the object, is the bondage of the individual. The power by which we are compelled to be intensely conscious of that which is other than ourselves is the samsara, so-called, the involvement of every individual in a terrible, unintelligible network of suffering. The Gaunatman or the secondary self is the object of our desire, to put it precisely. It may be son, it may be daughter, it may be wife, it may be husband, it may be any blessed thing. Now, why do you call these objects as yourself? In what sense you regard them as an Atman, though it may be a secondary self or a Gaunatman? Now, it is impossible to love anything which is not a self. Atman or the self alone is the object of desire. No one can love anything except the self. And even when you love anything apparently other than yourself, you convert it into a self in some artificial manner. Otherwise, love for a thing or a person is unthinkable in this world. So even when you love your father or son or husband or wife or wealth, you are loving your own self in a terribly mistaken manner. A person is totally out of gear psychologically in a terrible misconception when one's affections are poured over those things which cannot in any way identify with oneself, for reasons already mentioned in the context of the Sutra of Patanjali, Parinama, Tapa, etc. You can never come in contact with anything. Yet, you have no other desire in this world except the desire to come in contact. Life is a contradiction, it appears. It pulls us powerfully from two different directions in contrary ways. The Gaunatman, therefore, is the secondary self, a self which is imagined, foisted upon that which can never become the self. The object can never become the subject, and your object of love or affection cannot become you. It cannot satisfy you. It is not you. You have no connection with it. Yet, you seem to be concerned only with that. This is the wisdom to which you are initiated by the social atmosphere in which you are born and the education that you receive in this world. This is a travesty indeed in which we find ourselves. You know very well why there should be withdrawal of consciousness from such contacts. In the process of self-control, in the execution of the art of yoga. There is also the other false self called the Mithyatman, which is the psychophysical individuality. This so-called I, this physical I, this bodily I, this psychic I, this sensory I, etc. I am coming, I am seated here, I shall go there, I shall do this, I am hungry, I am thirsty, I am happy, I am unhappy. When you make statements of this kind, you are referring to a false self in which you are involved. This false self is called the Mithyatman, consisting of the five sheaths to which we have already made reference. The koshas, so called, the physical, vital, mental, intellectual, and the causal, annamaya, pranamaya, manomaya, vijnanamaya, anandamaya koshas, which are accretions grown over the central consciousness, which is the true Atman or the Mukhyatman, the primary self. Accretions, not vitally connected with the self, so much unconnected as clouds are in relation to the space in which we are, in which they are. You know how thick clouds can hang over our heads and appear to contaminate space and cloud even the sun himself. But the clouds do not cover the sun and they do not contaminate space, though it appears that they do this. Like thick layers of clouds, this Mithyatman consists of unfulfilled longing. They include what you call the subconscious layer, the unconscious layer, etc. They are the psychic personality of ours, the emotional, the vital, the volitional, etc. And even the physical bodily self. Other than this Gaunatman or the secondary self, the object of our love and hatred, other than this foisted false self, the five koshas, there is a true subjectivity in us, in the direction of which we move gradually along the lines of the cosmological scheme laid before us by the Sankhya, which the Vedanta also accepts in many of its features. The self has to be raised by the self, says the Bhagavad Gita, Uddhared Atman Atman. The self is the friend of the self, Bandhur Atmatmanas Tasya. Your own self is your friend, and your self has to guide yourself. You may become your friend and you may also become your enemy under certain given conditions. Atmaiva hyatmano bandhuhu, atmaiva riparatmanah. You have no friends outside you, you have no enemies outside you. You are your friend, you are your enemy. When you see friends outside and enemies outside, again you are committing this mistake of identifying yourself with the Gaunatman. The secondary self takes possession of the true self, as it were, with such power and intensity of grasp that we seem to be seeing ourselves in our so-called externalized forms of friends and enemies, while really we have gone against the larger dimension of our own higher self when we confront enemies in this world, and we are in harmony with the dimension of our own higher self when we see friends around us. Thus, the objects of the world do not concern us unless our self is connected with them in some way or the other, positively in love or negatively in hatred. Thus, we are living in a world of self and not in a world of objects. The so-called objects are not our concern, and they become our concern. They become even the objects of our awareness of their being there on account of the consciousness moving towards them, enveloping them, entering them, possessing them, and getting identified with them in some manner, which is the epistemological process in the perception of an object. We cannot even know that the world exists unless we move outwardly in space and time in the direction of another location where we place ourselves for the time being, either in love or hatred, so that even there we are coming in contact with our own selves only in a larger manner. Thus, idam sarvam yadayam atma, all this universe is self laid out before the experiencing consciousness with which the self is identified and vice versa. The whole universe is self, and the objects so called are misconceived locations and spatially conceived positions of this universally pervasive self, which is the Atman. This is a philosophical background of the necessity for the practice of self-control and meditation. When you understand this background, you will also know automatically the techniques that you have to adopt in the control of the senses, in the practice of self-restraint, in meditation on reality, which will be the subject of the sixth chapter. Hari Om Tat Sat.